Rashmi Sanjay, and you are listening to CKMS 102.7 FM Radio Waterloo, bringing you your community stories this Saturday morning, July the 27th. So today in my studio, I have Suzanne Dietrich and Rebecca Wankan. But my first guest, Suzanne Dietrich, is a registered dietitian and the owner of Gut Instincts Nutrition Counseling, where she specializes in helping people make peace with food, and will join me in conversation to talk about gut health and the various battles we have either struggled with or are still struggling with. Be it getting sucked into the numerous diets that are out there or just felt shame about our bodies. We seem to be in this love-hate relationship with food. We're going to be talking about it all here today. Thank you, Suzanne, for joining me in studio this morning. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you, Rashmi. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, gut instincts. How and where did this whole journey with nutrition begin for you?
For me, my journey with nutrition began when I was born, for most of us, but to specialize in nutrition, I worked for 10 years in the nonprofit sector in KW at various organizations, the Working Center, House of Friendship Emergency Food Hamper Program, and I was learning a lot about how different sorts of people don't have access to food. And
absolutely.
So that was something I was really passionate about. And so I decided to become a dietitian because I wanted to work more on helping develop and influence policy around food security and making sure that all individuals have access to food.
Mm-hmm.
I did my degree at Ryerson, and when I finished that, I realized that I didn't really want to work at a policy level. I really missed working one-to-one with people. And so then I worked for 5 years at community health centers and a family health team. And most recently, in the past few years, started my business. And now I'm working towards helping people develop a healthy relationship to food and making sure that all people have access to health, and regardless of their body size or shape.
Mm-hmm. But this whole journey also began, you worked and volunteered in a non-for-profit sector, and you saw what it was, food and the challenges that have gone in there. So did that kind of trigger the whole thing for you?
Absolutely, absolutely. And so during my internship, I did a placement at Homewood Health Center. And that's where I learned about the concept of health at every size and intuitive eating. So it's about ensuring that everyone has access to treatment for health.
Mm-hmm.
It's also about respectful treatment of all sizes and offering a path for wellness beyond weight.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's about teaching people how to eat in accordance with their hunger and satiety cues that are in line with their body's natural needs rather than rigid prescriptions on a diet, for example.
When people come to you asking, I need help, and they struggle with different diets that are out there, how challenging does it get for you to suggest what's right, what's not? Because in the market, we have tons of those, and it's so hard to make those choices. We are either testing them on ourselves, or we read those blogs and say, okay, maybe this is what I need. So how does one know what's appropriate?
It can be so confusing. It's, and even for myself as a dietitian who studied nutrition, it is very confusing. Generally, what I try and help people do, people generally come to me with a lot of knowledge around nutrition.
Mm-hmm.
And so I try and help them figure out what is the best way of eating for them. So, you know, what works for their budget, what works for their time, their stress management, their health, all of those factors, and help them kind of dismantle some of the myths that they have around health.
Mm-hmm.
You know, eating balanced meals. I try and help them understand what eating feels like for them. And rather than rely on, you know, external rules of, you know, I should eat this much at this time, it's about helping them understand the cues that their body is giving them. So, for example, we're all born with an ability to recognize when we're hungry and full. If you've ever watched a toddler eat, when they're hungry, what are they doing?
Yeah.
They're usually screaming, crying, I'm hungry right
cranky.
Now. Cranky. Cranky, exactly. And then what happens when they're full? What do they do with their food?
Yeah, they push it away.
They push it away. And so they know very well when they're hungry and when they're full.
Mm-hmm.
Those cues start to get distorted when there's outside influences telling us what we should eat, when we should eat, and how much we should eat.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a teenager, sometimes we might be rushing out the door, so we'd skip our breakfast. So that is kind of the beginning of ignoring those hunger cues. Or if one starts to diet to change their body shape or size, then they'll start to ignore those hunger cues again. And so often when I see people, when they walk through my door, they don't know if they're hungry or full. They often can relate to feelings of extreme hunger and feelings of extreme fullness, but it's hard to figure out what's in between. So what I help people do is not so much telling them what to eat,
yeah.
It's helping them to figure out what their body cues are to start with.
Mm-hmm. So do you go back to see where the trigger started and also what history has been in the past?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. I ask people, you know, what's your relationship like with food? And, you know, how did it work for you growing up in your household? You know, mm-hmm. what were some of those rules that your family had? And I look at what are some of the rules you have for yourself and how are those rules harming you? You know, I have sometimes people who say, well, I can't eat this food group. But then what happens if they are restricting that food group throughout the day? Then sometimes our body has hormonal systems that tell us, gives us signals that we need to have that food. And so sometimes people are overeating those foods at night because eventually our body just gives us very strong signals that we need those types of nutrients.
Mm-hmm. There are people also battling eating disorders, be it anorexia or other kind of challenges. So how do you help? How does your work that you do help? And what are the kind of challenges eating disorder can bring about?
Yeah, so unfortunately, eating disorders affect many people in Canada. It's approximately 1 million people. And unfortunately, the access to care for eating disorder treatment is very limited. So what I generally do is I will see them and just learn about what their relationship with food is like, what kind of food they are eating, how much, when, and look at some of those rules and help them normalize their relationship with food and break down some of the myths or fears that they have around food. I also link them up with a therapist or make sure they are speaking to their doctor, make sure they're getting all the lab work done because it can be very risky. We know that 75% of people with severe eating disorders unfortunately die before they have access to care in Ontario.
Oh, wow.
So this is a crisis that we have. So it's all about normalizing their relationship with food and helping them develop an attitude or philosophy that all foods fit and eventually helping to learn them to learn about their hunger and fullness cues. But at the beginning, usually sometimes their brain is very ill from the eating disorder that they can't trust those cues in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
So we do what's called mechanical eating. So we get them to eat, you know, start with eating a certain amount of food. And then once their body gets used to that and their brain heals a bit, then we can start to teach them about their hunger and fullness cues.
Okay.
The other piece that is very important with that is to help teach them that one size does not fit all.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the biggest misconceptions with eating disorders is that they only affect people in thin bodies.
That's interesting.
Yeah. People are affected by eating disorders at all sizes.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, many eating disorders go undiagnosed because of this perception that they only affect people in thin bodies when there are people in all sorts of bodies that are very ill and need help.
So what are the cues that one can get to recognize that, you know, maybe this is an eating disorder? Like, would there be signs that trigger and say, okay, maybe I need to go get this checked?
Yeah, so sometimes it can affect their mental health, so they might have trouble sleeping, they might have trouble concentrating, their memory might be, you know, not as good as it used to be. And then often it's this kind of compulsion with food, whether it's how they eat their food, or if they're only eating certain foods, or if they're weighing or measuring their foods. It's also preoccupation with their body and often wanting to change their body. And so those are kind of, and for some people it might be change in weight, but for other people there's not a change in weight. So we can't keep defining an eating disorder as related to weight change.
Mm-hmm. If people are looking to move away from chronic dieting, now what is chronic dieting to begin with?
Yeah, good question. Chronic dieting is when somebody has been on a prescribed diet, or it might even just be a little lifestyle change that is really kind of consuming them. And they put other things on hold to make sure that their diet is followed. So, for example, they might not join friends for dinner because they're afraid that that item might be served and they're going to have trouble declining it. Mm-hmm. They might not go out to restaurants. They're counting points or calories or certain macronutrients to an obsessive point. That's kind of chronic dieting. Okay. And it's when it's ongoing, and it's just, you know, I have clients who have told me that this has taken up so much of their life mentally, their time, and financially as well. Mm-hmm. So I've seen people as young as 8 years old who've been on a diet.
Wow.
And people who've been dieting for 50 years of their life. So that's what I would term a chronic dieter, someone who has had this tumultuous relationship with food for a long time. Mm-hmm. That would be chronic, but even for a short period of time, we know that dieting can lead to an increased rate of disordered eating and eating disorders.
Mm-hmm. And again, like you mentioned, take those nutrients in certain foods that are supposed to be a part of our regular diets, but because we so strictly follow certain chronic diet regime, we lose those nutrients, and that can also take a toll into something completely different, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
When you say you develop a love-hate relationship with food, again, that also falls into the different diets that are out there, or the chronic diet pattern that people follow. Now, I know, like, juicing and, you know, getting the fibers in or not getting them in, that's a part of the new diet fad as well. And people do it with fruits, people do it with vegetables, or just go light with eating just a certain amount. And how does your plan kind of incorporate into what they're doing, but yet kind of give them a solution saying, okay, you can still do what you're doing, because, you know, not everyone will want to change what they're doing because it's helping them in some way with certain issues, but also you don't want them getting into another side of spectrum where they're losing out on all those nutrients. So what do you tell people who still want to stick on to what they're doing?
That's a good question. So I think it's, for me, it's all about, how is that making you feel? How is that making you feel mentally and physically? You know, what's your energy level? What's your mental energy? How are you sleeping? What's your stress level? You know, I sometimes have clients who, you know, they're working so hard on having such a nutritious diet. Mm-hmm. But I remind them that nutrition is just one component of health, right? There's how we move our bodies, how we sleep, our stress level, our relationships with family and friends, our employment, our involvement in the community, our financial health, our environmental health. So when we look at all those factors that contribute to health, if we're focusing just on one, sometimes those other areas of health can suffer. So I had one client who wanted a specific bread, so they'd drive to one store to get the specific bread, and another store to get the specific fish, and another store to get the vegetables. Mm-hmm. And so that's great if that person has that time and that's working for them. But at the same time, this person shared with me that they just felt so much stress around all this time that they're putting into it, and that was affecting their mental health. So I think when it comes to health, each person needs to define what their definition of health is.
Sure.
And it's not something that we can put health, our definition on other people. And if people want to change their health, that's their own choice. Mm-hmm. But we can't put our definition of health on other people, in my opinion. It's my job to help people understand how nutrition can affect their life, mm-hmm. but it's not the only aspect of health.
And you also talk about intuitive eating. Mm-hmm. What is intuitive eating all about? I haven't heard that before. Is this something new that the word's used?
Yeah. So intuitive eating was developed by two dietitians, Evelyn Tribbley and Lise Reich in the U.S. Started in the late 90s, and it's based on 10 principles. And again, the philosophy behind it is developing a relationship with food that works for you. Mm-hmm. So it's about rejecting the diet mentality. It's about learning to honor your hunger and respect your fullness. It's about making peace with food so that all foods are equal. And it's also about having foods that are satisfying and enjoying. Oftentimes I meet people and they're just eating foods for nutrition, but what they're eating is not satisfying it as well. Mm-hmm. So it's about bringing some of those foods in too.
Okay.
It's also about respecting our bodies and understanding that we all have a genetic blueprint when it comes to weight, and not everyone is going to be thin. Mm-hmm. I am someone who is privileged because I live in a thin body. So how I move in the world, how I access healthcare, mm-hmm. education, how I exist, that gives me a lot of privileges. Whereas somebody who's in a larger body, that's their genetic blueprint. But unfortunately, it can get demonized by society and by our healthcare institutions. So it's recognizing that bodies are diverse, mm-hmm. and we welcome all bodies, and all bodies deserve access to care and respect. Sure.
And we also love spending time, more time, you know, with enjoying life and doing things outdoors. But it does get to a point when you're in these social gatherings in other places, what we put in our mouths today. Do you think intuitive eating kind of plays a part there?
Yeah, so the diet industry is very strong. It's a $1 billion industry. And one time I heard somebody say that if the diet industry, you know, faltered, then the stock market would crash. Okay. So, and I have clients who've told me that they spent thousands and thousands of dollars on dieting. So definitely intuitive eating is a way to help us. It can improve health for some individuals, mm-hmm. but also help us find, increased body satisfaction, increased self-esteem, increased mental health. And also, for many people, they change their relationship with food and they don't have this love-hate relationship anymore.
Mm-hmm. And you also mentioned about eating disorder recovery. What is that about? Is that a plan that you put people on, or is it just for a specific group of people, like eating disorder?
Yeah, so eating disorder recovery is for people who have eating disorders.
Okay.
A lot of times I meet people who haven't been diagnosed with an eating disorder, but they have a lot of the symptoms. So I don't diagnose people. That's not in my scope of practice. So I encourage mm-hmm. them to see their doctor. But eating disorder recovery is helping them move away from some of the symptoms and behaviors that they have that is affecting their mental and physical health. And so it's a process.
Okay.
That often includes a dietitian, a physician, a psychologist or social worker, or psychotherapist.
Okay.
At times, it can be worked on in an outpatient setting, or it can be worked, they need to move to an inpatient setting,
mm-hmm.
Of which there is very limited access in Ontario and in Canada. And I recently heard Jill Andrews speak. She's an MPP in Toronto St. Paul community, and she is pushing for Bill 61, which is a bill to recognize Eating Disorder Awareness Week in Ontario.
That's fabulous.
Many other provinces have this, mm-hmm. and it is one of the first steps that we need to get more action and treatment available for people with eating disorders.
Yeah, it's a huge deal, and it's unfortunate that some of them are able to access care and get help, while the rest of them, and like you said, a lot of people even die from it.
Yes, and unfortunately, the rate of eating disorders worldwide has doubled since 2000. Wow. So we're seeing an increase in that. We're also seeing an increase in restrictive eating disorders in children. And in fact, it's 2 times greater, the incidence of restrictive eating disorders, than type 2 diabetes in children. So we have work to do. And I think also in our schools, there is work that can be done in terms to help children honor their hunger and fullness cues, mm-hmm. and move away from labeling foods from healthy and unhealthy, because sometimes our children who have these developing brains can latch on to something and then think that they need to have these restrictive eating patterns when that is not unnecessary and their body has the cues to tell them what they need.
You also talk about the non-diet approach. I understand the dieting part, but when you talk about non-diet approach, what does that include?
So the non-diet approach includes that it's based on the principle that, you know, health and wellness can be fostered independently of weight. And so when people come to me, I help them focus not only on weight, or, you know, I challenge them to think about health goals that aren't related to weight. So what is something that you'd like to do with your body or your mind or in your life that's going to make things easier for you? Mm-hmm. So for some people, their digestive health is not well. So they want to feel comfortably when they get up in the morning. Mm-hmm. For other people, they'd like to be able to play basketball with their children for longer than 10 minutes. For other people, they would like to have more energy. So it's looking at goals for their health that they develop, and I help them develop in tandem, that isn't focusing on weight, because the literature tells us that dieting is not successful in the long run. It can lead to maladaptive eating behaviors and body shame, and can lead to weight gain as well too. And that moves people away from their set point weight, which is the weight that their body is, you know, genetically predetermined.
And what do you tell people who feel body shaming? That's huge, right? It starts early on and it goes right into, you know, a part of, and that carries on for years. How does one tackle that?
It is huge,
it
right?
Is huge.
And I think so we need to tackle it at many levels. So externally, we need to look at where body shaming is present in our society. It's present in the education system. It's present in the political system, the medical system, the religious system. So it's present in many external systems. And then we need to look at how it is in our family life, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, we talk about in our house that all bodies are good bodies, and all body parts are good body parts as well, too. And people have different body parts, and that's okay. And then I look at internally. I help people look internally at what has gone on and where they feel that shame and why, and help them understand that this isn't all their fault. None of it is their fault. It's mm-hmm. the society that we live in.
That's
so it's
creating.
Helping people change their lens on health, and realizing that, you know, we're not virtuous because we're a certain size.
Mm-hmm.
It's what our genetics predetermined for us.
For sure. And if people need to reach out to you and see the work you're doing and get in touch with you, where do they book appointments or talk
to
you?
Sure. Yeah. So my website is www.gutinstincts.ca. And I'm also on Facebook at Gut Instincts Nutrition Counseling. Or you can find me on Instagram mm-hmm. at Suzanne.DietrichRD. And I'd love to chat more about this with anyone who's interested, because it is a different approach, but it is one that is gaining more momentum, thankfully.
For sure. Is there any words or suggestions you have to tell people on how to take care of their gut and how important it is in today's times?
Yeah, so I think how to take care of their gut, listen to what your body is telling you, and seek out some assistance if you need that. Mm-hmm. And for gut health, people with IBS, it's very individual. So sometimes what is deemed as healthy isn't healthy for some people's gut if they have, you know, a gut health condition.
Mm-hmm. So I have one question with regard to that you just mentioned. They talk about eliminating sugar from diets, right? That's a huge challenge for many people, including me. And what I put in, and every food has some amount of sugar in it, whether it's, you know, processed, unprocessed, contains sugar in it. How does one work on that? Because it does play a huge part in, be it emotional or your weight or just your basic health.
Well, I don't think people should be eliminating sugar.
Okay.
I think sugar is the latest food that's nutrient that's being demonized, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. All foods have sugar, like you said. Many foods have sugar, you know, fruits, vegetables, grains. Mm-hmm. And so sugar breaks down into glucose, and that is the best source of fuel for our brain to function. And so I think when it comes to processed sugar, you know, absolutely, it tastes good, it's delicious. And so what I encourage people to do is find something that you really enjoy and see if you can eat it mindfully, eat it slowly, really pay attention to that. Mm-hmm. When we avoid certain nutrients, we end up restricting, and then usually for most people binging on them. And again, my philosophy around health is what is sustainable for you. So if eating an ice cream every day or every once in a while, if that's what's sustainable for you and that will help you eat, you know, the rest of the day, you know, with balanced meals, then that's great. Maybe you're eating 3 ice cream cones a day. Maybe not ideal. How's that going to make you feel mentally and physically? Mm-hmm. But when we avoid anything, it often leads to binging. It's like if you had a toddler in the room, and on one side of the room you had about 50 toys, and then on the other side you had one toy on its own, and you said to the toddler, you can play with all of those 50 toys, but you can't play with that one. What is the toddler going to want to do?
And we carry those instincts right into our adulthood too. It's the same concept. Yep.
Yeah. Intuitive eating it's about gentle nutrition. So absolutely. It doesn't deny the principles of nutrition, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But it's about learning how to eat mindfully and find foods that taste delicious and satiating. And those includes foods that are whole foods and some that are processed, some that are sweet, some that aren't sweet.
Thank you so much, Suzanne, for being here and sharing with our listeners some and giving us some great advice and information. Stay tuned. I'll be right back with my next guest, Rebecca Wankan. Those of you who are just tuning in, you are listening to In Conversation with Rashmi on CKMS 102.7 FM Radio Waterloo, bringing you your community stories this Saturday morning, July the 27th. What you're about to hear involves sexual abuse, and for some, it could trigger disturbing thoughts. So if you need someone to talk to, please call 24-hour support line at 519-741-8633. My next guest here today has been through some soul-wrenching times in her life that we cannot even begin to imagine. Rebecca Wankan, thank you so much for being here this morning. And it does take a lot of courage and strength to come out and share with me and our listeners your journey. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, Rashmi. It's an honor to be here.
Thank you. You have been through so much in your life. Very early on, we decided to do the show just so, you know, people can listen and understand what goes into shutting down and not talking about it for years, and also helping others understand to talk about it, get that stigma out of the system, and there's help to be reached out to. So thank you for coming and doing this, and it's a pleasure to have you here. So take us back to what happened and where this whole thing started from.
So it was when I was about in the 4th or 5th grade. My timeline is not super accurate because often in situations like this, people can either remember all of the details very specifically,
for sure,
or the mind can kind of shut down and block things out. So a lot of my childhood years are just kind of black holes. I don't remember a whole lot. But when it did start, I was up camping with my family on Manitoulin Island, and it was a shock, to say the least. I remember it starting, but I don't remember it ending. I don't remember how I got back to camp. I don't remember how I responded to it. Mm-hmm. And it was done by a family member.
Mm-hmm.
And that made it even harder, right? Because then you're spending years and years terrified to go forward, because what if somebody doesn't believe you? Or what if it doesn't matter?
Mm-hmm.
And it's difficult to even get that out and tell that story, especially when you are so young.
Absolutely.
So I was about 8 when it started, give or take.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't stop until I was 13. And luckily, he didn't live nearby. He lived a number of hours away.
Mm-hmm.
So it was only during family functions, mostly during the summertime, when there would be opportunities for that to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So I was actually kind of lucky in that respect, that there were months at a time when I was safe and periods of time where I wasn't.
Mm-hmm. And you also reached out to your immediate family saying this was happening. At what point did you decide, okay, this is something's not right here, I need to talk to somebody about it?
So when it was the summer going into grade 9, we had just come back from our family camping trip, and another survivor had come forward to me and said, hey, I think this happened, but I'm really not sure, but it really didn't feel unintentional. And at that time, like, I just broke down crying, and I couldn't even believe that because I hadn't said something, something had happened to someone I loved.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the scariest thing to have to recognize that my own lack of strength, as I perceived it in that time,
mm-hmm.
really had caused harm to come to someone that I cared for. So at that point, I had someone on my side who was with me.
Mm-hmm.
But I still didn't tell anybody for a couple months. And then that survivor actually came forward to me and said, hey, we're telling your mom. And I was like, please don't make me do this. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't want to do this. She's like, we have to tell your mom.
Mm-hmm.
She needs to know, and we have to tell her.
Sure.
And I remember the night like it was yesterday. Like, it was right after cheerleading practice. I was just leaving the school, and it was pouring down rain. It was like something out of a movie. Mm-hmm. And she met me halfway, and we're just standing in the rain. And I'm like crying, mm-hmm. because I'm terrified to tell my mom.
Sure.
And it's just pouring. And we get in the car, and it's dead silent the whole ride home.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're sitting in the car after we get home, and my mom kind of knew that something was going on because we weren't having a conversation. We weren't talking. Like, it was just this really awkward tension.
Mm-hmm.
And the other survivor shared her story and then prompted my story to mm-hmm. come into it. And that was the first time that I actually shared with my family what happened. After that night, we didn't really talk about it. It was pretty quiet, and I remember it was about 6 months before it got brought up again, because my abuser was coming to visit, and I was freaking out because I didn't know what was happening. I didn't mm-hmm. know if they had talked to him. I didn't know if it had been resolved. I didn't know what was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So I was really nervous. And then after he came to visit, somehow, and to this day, like, I don't know the full truth of how it happened,
mm-hmm.
But somehow he was sent to pick me up alone,
mm-hmm.
and I had no other option but to get in the car. He is a large man,
mm-hmm.
and he is terrifying, and I was 13, and so I got in the car, and we drove home. My house was only about 5-minute drive from the school, but on that drive home, there was an opportunity, and he took it.
Mm-hmm.
And I just remember how devastating that was for me to have this experience after I've come forward. Mm-hmm. And it really just solidified all of my fears, you know, that I wasn't believed. And he still got another chance even after everything that mm-hmm. I had gone through and after I had come forward. And I remember getting home, and I went up right up to my parents' room, and I just lost it. Mm-hmm. And I remember getting into this huge argument with my mom about her not believing me and how he was sent to pick me up. And I was so upset. And again, I don't know how he got sent to pick mm-hmm. me up. I'm not sure who sent him.
So that whole 6 months from the time you told them till this episode happened again,
mm-hmm.
there was no talk of it with you, but what was running in your head? You just began to assume it was taken care of, someone had dealt with it.
I was just kind of left questioning, you know, the conversation had been had, and then that was it, right? So you're kind of hoping, like, my parents know now, they're going to take care of it. Mm-hmm. And it's a tough conversation to have.
It is.
It's not a conversation I ever want to have with children that I may have. Mm-hmm. I couldn't imagine being in that situation and trying to wrap my head around it, especially mm-hmm. when it is somebody who's in the family that allegation is being put on, mm-hmm. right? So to have that come to light and try to wrap your head around it, I can't even imagine mm-hmm. how difficult that would be.
But what did you go through telling them? Did it give you a sense of, okay, at least I've shared it?
A little bit, but not much. Mm-hmm. Being left in the dark as to what was happening, it just kind of heightened that anxiety, right? Of like, mm-hmm. now more people know, but I don't know what's going to happen.
True.
And those questions can just spin out of control, right? They put you in a vortex and you get sucked right into them. Mm-hmm. And it definitely brought me a little bit darker mm-hmm. Than I already was, which was already in a very dark place. Position.
So after that pickup and you were dropped off, mm-hmm. did you get to see that person again?
I have, yeah. He's still involved in my family to this day. Granted, some things have changed mm-hmm. within that dynamic as we went through the process of the court system this past year. However, all these years he's been involved in my family.
But things have changed since you took writing.
Yes.
To start getting you into that healing process, right? So
yeah.
Writing became a huge part in your life, and yeah. that started early on. Did you always write?
No, I didn't. Funny enough, I didn't even read nonfiction books. Like, oh. I only read fiction. I loved it, and I would get lost in it, and that was my escape for the entire period that the abuse was actually going on. Mm-hmm. But then I went to college. When I went back to college for child and youth care, I met my best friend, and she brought writing into my life. Mm-hmm. She wrote these really, really wonderful pieces of just her emotions, her raw emotions on these pages, and it was gorgeous. And it just really inspired me to try to take what was going on inside of me and putting it on paper and seeing what that could do
to you and people who read.
Yes. So I started writing, and the only person I would show was her. Like, I didn't show anybody okay. my beginning work. And it wasn't until about 4 years later that I actually started writing a blog and actually sharing it with mm-hmm. everybody. It's a vulnerable thing to do, knowing that you're putting yourself out on the line like that, and you're mm-hmm. putting something out there that's there forever now.
Absolutely.
So, but once I did, it was so relieving, and it was so powerful. And I really found a lot of healing in that, knowing that everything I had gone through had led me up to using my voice to help people and bringing some form of light to all of the darkness that I had gone through.
Absolutely. And in writing, you also, between, you know, those years that you went through whatever you did and starting to write, did you decide at some point, I need to also seek help elsewhere and talk to people about it?
I did, yeah. It took a really long time. For most of my life, I kind of faced it on my own. I had the previous survivor also. Like, we were each other's support system through it all.
For sure.
But I didn't have access to supports. I didn't know where to find them. I didn't even know that there was options out there for survivors. Like, it was very, it's a very hush-hush type of industry, and it's only just beginning to be more vocalized. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't until about a year ago that I actually seeked out counseling mm-hmm. and moved through that. And then I also found, I did some research and I reached out to SASC in Waterloo, and they gave me some lists of options. And as I sifted through their list, I was able to find group therapy that's free of cost as well. So it's available for everybody. which is wonderful. It's really great. So now I have that as well.
But it's unfortunate that it took you this many years to figure out there was something out there. Mm-hmm. And would you say stigma played a big role in that too, because of the fear and the society putting it in a certain way?
Yeah, it definitely did. It's really difficult to find resources about something that people don't want to talk about. Mm-hmm. Because even now there's times where people get really uncomfortable when it comes up, right? And if you can't even talk about it yourself, how are you going to find the resources who are willing to talk to you about it?
Mm-hmm.
So that was even why I started getting into the career that I did. I really wanted to aim towards counseling, because people need to know that services are out there, and people need to know that people are there for them.
Mm-hmm.
And not everybody has that. So our services need to be more well known. They shouldn't be secrets that are kept between the groups that know about them.
Mm-hmm.
It shouldn't be that hard to find services, and especially free services, because a lot of the people that are going through this, they're younger. And if you get help earlier on, you can grow and you can move through it in a more positive way and really up your chances of not getting sucked down deeper into everything else that can come into your life because of it.
Absolutely. And again, touching on, it took you 20-something years to actually come out and seek that help, which is a long time.
It is,
It's unfortunate that it did. And in the process, because of not having that access, you ended up also getting into relationships where, you know, abuse became a part of it again.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you go through abuse at a young age, right, that becomes your definition of what love is, especially when it's coming from a family member.
Mm-hmm.
So it really skews your perspective of it. And without the access and without the people around you who can help you through it and help you understand it and be there for you while you're moving through this, it's really hard to stay on a healthy path. And you get sucked in to just trying to find love where you can get it. And people prey on that.
Mm-hmm.
So unfortunately, I did end up in an abusive relationship. You know, the first year it seemed great. I thought it was okay. But there was a lot of mind games at play that I wasn't aware of, because I was only 17 at the time. You don't pick up on those red flags.
Mm-hmm.
And then after I moved in with him, it was 2 years that I was stuck in a relationship where I was scared for my life every day. You know, there was a lot of rape that happened. There was a lot of abuse and physical and emotional and mental abuse that all went into it.
Mm-hmm.
And it made it really hard to leave. And when you're under the belief that no one can love you and this is as good as you're ever going to get, you don't want to leave, because that's a terrifying thing to have to come up against. But if you have those services that can teach you and show you, hey, you're a human being, you're worth so much more, you're going to see those red flags a little bit clearer. You're not going to overlook them in hopes to be loved.
Mm-hmm.
And especially as a child, having free services to go to makes it so much more accessible. And then if you're not ready to tell your family, at least there's a service you can go to and they can help you until you're ready.
Absolutely.
But those services are very hard to come by.
Do you think more people talking about it and coming out and sharing their stories and reaching out to people they trust, and because trust plays a huge part in this too?
Absolutely.
Right? You've lost it at a very young age. People you've confided into, there's no trust there. So doing that, taking that step, could change the way things move in today's time?
I think it could. And you know, we're already in this massive move, especially with the Me Too movement, right? We're in this huge move where people are finally starting to come forward, even against like the big players, right?
Yeah.
And having that and seeing that as a victim and as a survivor, seeing that happen gives you that hope that, hey, something can actually be done with this.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't have to be this terribly scary thing, because look at all these people that are doing it.
Mm-hmm.
It's real. I'm not alone.
Yep.
And it really just makes it, as bad as it can sound, normal. Right? It normalizes it enough that you're able to process it and move through it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the more we talk about it, the more people will feel accepted and understood. And they know that there are people in their community that get it. They've been through it. Then they really understand it on a genuine level of Absolutely. Experience.
Absolutely. So you finished your first writing your book.
I did.
And you started working on your second manuscript.
Yes.
That's amazing. So that focuses more on aspects of survivors.
Yeah, so my first one, I'm toying with the title of Finding the Light, and okay. it's just 50 short pieces of ways that anybody can bring more empowerment and more light into their life. Mm-hmm. And it's really just simple things that if we just pay attention enough and we really tune into ourselves, we can bring into our world to overcome pretty much anything. And my second one is all about the actual healing of trauma survivors. Mm-hmm. And it'll be a little bit more intensive, but it'll be well worth the time it takes to write, because
sure.
I know I would have loved to have a resource like that where I could go and find these things that have worked and hear someone's piece of it and their side of that story, right? And how they moved through it. It makes it a little bit more real.
Absolutely.
So I'm really looking forward to getting that going and moving through the process.
So can people read what you've written before? I know the Written Compass
yes.
is your first place where you started writing and yeah. putting it down. So do people have access to that? Which
yeah, so therittencompass.com is my website, and it does have all of my future or past blog posts.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing from my book is on there. It won't be released until I either find a literary agent or an actual publishing house to take on my manuscript and bring it out. But to get samples of my work and to really see what it is I'm all about in my writing, a lot of stuff is still on my website.
Okay.
Yeah.
And is there anything to other survivors or, you know, people who still hesitate to come out and share their story and talk to someone? Is there something you would like to tell them?
I would just want everybody to know that they're not alone. And there's a lot of people that are willing to stand for you.
Mm-hmm.
And it may not be the people that you expect. And, you know, making that decision to come forward is an incredibly hard one to make. But you don't have to do it alone. There are services out there. You just have to find them. And it may take some time. But the more you start talking about it, the more you become a little bit more comfortable with your story, you will find the services and you will find the people who can point you to them.
Absolutely. Rebecca, I can't thank you enough. Your courage to share your story is inspiring. And I'm sure you've touched many souls out there listening today and have provided some light to whatever darkness they may feel or be facing and helped them find strength to continue their journey into a more positive and healing path. So thank you so much, and wishing you nothing but the very, very best. It's been a pleasure having you here.
Thank you so much, Rashmi. I really enjoyed it, and I really hope that what I've said really resonates with some people. And
Absolutely.
I just want them to know they're not alone.
Absolutely.
So thank you so much.
Thank you.